Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro Libertate Radio, a full throttle, no holds barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gregg. Drop
what you're doing. I see stories like this probably two or three times a day, and I've never been able to shake my conviction that this sort of thing is happening more frequently. It's not a question of it becoming more visible. I honestly think that we're seeing a generational change in law enforcement and the outworking of some deliberate institutional changes that occurred over the past several decades, I think beginning with the Great Society effort to federalize law enforcement, but certainly accelerating under Richard Nixon. He cynically, and of course everything he does, he did cynically. Everything he did, I should say, he did cynically, by way of creating a generational rift that was exploitable, wrapped himself in the garb of law and order, even as he committed one of the greatest crimes in history by taking the United States government off the gold standard. I mean, that was far bigger than any bank robbery one can imagine. But I think that there has been a definable, documentable change in law enforcement culture in a way that's very, very disturbing. The headline to this article is Felony Charges Against Geneva Officer Dropped. Geneva, Wisconsin is what we're talking about. The dateline is Elkhorn. Walworth County prosecutors have agreed to drop felony charges against a former police sergeant accused of mishandling evidence because outside prosecutors thought the case lacked merit. Robert B. Haas, 42, who had been a member of the town of Geneva Police Department since 2001, has agreed to relinquish his badge. Judge Michael Gibbs in June ordered that a special prosecutor handle the case because of a conflict of interest between the Walworth County District Attorney's Office and Haas. Walworth County referred the case to the Wisconsin Attorney General's Office and the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office. Both offices declined to prosecute the case because they believed the charges could not be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. You know, stop there for a second. If this guy were a mere mundane, first of all, he wouldn't be handling evidence. It's entirely possible to be handling evidence as a mere mundane. But if he had done something that was similarly of a species of obstruction of justice, I think that the prosecutors would display greater zeal for doing justice as they pretend to understand it. Walworth County District Attorney Phil Koss said he had mixed feelings on the matter. Oh, I have mixed feelings about ambivalence. Rather than look like I was forum shopping, I agreed to drop the charges in exchange for his resignation, he said. This affected a significant case, that sexual assault case, but when two prosecuting officers say, we don't think there's enough here, then I'm not going to keep spending taxpayer money trying to pursue it. Wait a second, what's this about that sexual assault case? We'll get to that anon. Attorney Stephen Kramer said Haas already planned to resign. He would have found it unworkable to return to that police department, he said. Haas faced two charges of misconduct in public office. He was accused of mishandling evidence and reports in an April 2008 sexual assault case and others, according to the criminal complaint. Haas failed to document or secure evidence taken in the sexual assault case, including photographs and underwear, and failed to give prosecutors or defense attorneys evidence such as recorded interviews, according to the complaint. He botched the investigation, and the charges were reduced from felony repeated sexual assault of a child to misdemeanor fourth-degree sexual assault as a result, according to court records. He also had more than 80 pieces of evidence from various cases, including knives, drugs, and drug paraphernalia stored in or around his desk, according to the complaint. It would be interesting to know what use he was making of this evidence that he was just keeping in and around his desk. The Geneva Town Board recently voted to hire an attorney to review police reports and transcripts of hearings to see if the town could take any other disciplinary action against Haas. Town Chairman Dan Lauderdale has nixed that plan because it cannot pursue action against a former employee. The town is fortunate to be saving the cost of another hearing and other legal expenses, he said. Haas was demoted in November for engaging in conduct unbecoming an officer and mishandling evidence. He was accused of frequently meeting with a town court clerk during work hours. He was also accused of failing to properly package, label, and secure evidence taken in a number of cases after another officer took over his cases while he was suspended. Okay, here's the payoff. Haas now could seek a job with a different police department. I am confident, almost to the point of a moral certainty, that he will land on his feet. In this economy, he's going to find a place that will be willing to hire him. He's going to be given a government-issued costume, complete with government-issued junk jewelry and a gun, and clothed in the presumed right and authority to kill people who don't obey his instructions. In spite of the fact that he was cashiered in disgrace from this police department, I'm almost certain that will happen. There are gypsy cops by the tens of thousands who end up migrating from police department to police department once they have come into what should be career-terminating disrepute, and they end up landing on their feet until they do something that finally triggers the gag reflex of whatever town, village, or other community they afflict. And that's almost certainly going to happen here with this Mr. Haas. Lauderdale, a police officer in Williams Bay, expressed his concerns about Haas's future employment in the area or elsewhere. "I'm hopeful that should he apply elsewhere, that agency will do an adequate background investigation," he said. Haas echoed those sentiments. "I hope chiefs take this into consideration," he said. Kramer declined to comment further until the charges officially are dropped. He anticipated a judge would sign off on the agreement by the end of the week. Haas is expected to resign effective Monday. So he still has a few days left before he has his Frank Drebin moment. Some of you might remember Detective Lieutenant Frank Drebin from Police Squad, a special unit of the police force, played by the redoubtable Leslie Nielsen. Leslie Nielsen was once a very good serious actor. Hard to believe, but true. In any case, Lieutenant Detective Frank Drebin, in the first of the Naked Gun films, was forced to undergo the gun and badge ritual, which, of course, is a centerpiece of pretty much every big screen police drama. I'm going to need your gun, I'm going to need your badge. And as he's cleaning out his desk, contemplating his misfortune, no longer to be part of the killer elite, he muses to himself, "Just think about it. The next time I shoot somebody, I could go to jail." Well, Mr. Haas here in Geneva, Wisconsin, is probably thinking that he's got, another 48 hours or so, less than that. Another, 36 hours or thereabouts? Before he finally is deprived of this prerogative to inflict corporal misery upon people who look at him cross-eyed. Literally, if you take a look at the way that police are instructed to define resisting arrest, if you look at them in a certain way that displays hesitation, reluctance, rebellion, that's to be taken in consideration. They always talk about the totality of circumstances. If you brace yourself in a way that can be interpreted as a fighting stance without laying a hand on them, that's resisting arrest. And of course, if you lay a hand on them, it automatically becomes felony assault. Well, this guy is almost certainly going to end up finding a position on a different police force, different police agency somewhere, notwithstanding the circumstances under which he was cashiered. And so I doubt that he will have long to consider another career option. Not that there are plentiful career options right now. One of the things that is happening, as a matter of fact, is that there are some towns, some municipalities in this country, where there's serious consideration about reduction in forces of city police agencies and sheriff's agencies and things of that sort. There's a town in Texas that recently laid off 13 of its 15 police officers. Yeah, police officers, not deputy sheriffs. That is a remarkable development, but it's also an unusual one because, as I've said before, one of the highest priorities for the ruling elite right now is to make sure that the legions are well-fed and happy. And one of the things driving us ever closer to outright fiscal and financial ruin in this country is the financial burden of salary and benefit packages for government employees, including police unions. As a matter of fact, in places like California right now, that's likely to be the single element that's going to drive the state into Greece-style financial meltdown and outright rebellion in the streets, would be the burden of paying the benefit packages which were extorted from these communities during the flush times of the late boom. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call in number. Stand by for more Sedition after this. Here's a little note I got recently, if I can get it to come up on my computer, from a friend of mine. Just a second here. Here it is. I recently had an officer demand to know why I was blocking his street. I was just trying to pick up my second grader from school and was slowly inching my way with traffic into the school's turnabout. I called him on his comment. He was so upset he was spitting as he yelled and threatening to ticket me. He did not, but he had the whole police state black shades on, black leather jacket, and a belligerent tone down pretty good. So wrote my friend. This is something that falls under the heading of contempt of cop. Some of you may have read Joseph Wambaugh's novel, The Blue Knight. They made it into a regrettable television show starring George Kennedy. I never developed much patience for George Kennedy. He played a really hideous character in Charade, which is one of my favorite movies, and he will always and forever be that character, whatever role he was given. But there's actually a chapter in that novel that ends with the titular Blue Knight, beat cop in Los Angeles, beating the snot out of some punk juvenile delinquent who had mouthed off to him and telling him that he'd have to arrest him for contempt of cop. Actually, he wasn't going to arrest him. He was just dealing out summary street justice for contempt of cop. But that, of course, is part of the attitude we're dealing with as well. To the phones we go. Randy from Florida is with us this evening. Randy, how are you doing?
Well, let me pick your brain a little. Now that the judge has ruled on the Arizona law and basically gutted it, do you see the basis for her decision was that legal immigrants would be unfairly and unconstitutionally detained and caught up in this enforcement, and that would be a violation of their constitutional rights? Do you see any legitimacy or merit to that?
I'm sorry. She granted an injunction. I mean, that's an issue that supposedly is going to be settled by further litigation or perhaps rendered moot by going back and rewriting the law, as I understand it. But there is a problem here in that there are instances on record already of people who are U.S. citizens who have been detained by police who are already carrying out policies that are pretty similar to what would be codified under SB 1070. They've been detained because they've not been able to display a birth certificate in spite of the fact that they were born and raised in the United States. On more than one occasion that's happened. Just a couple of days ago, there was a protester who was arrested without any discernible cause. He's an American citizen. I don't particularly like his politics. He's somebody who's sort of attached to the, I guess you'd call it the Soros or Ford Foundation left. But he was arrested and then arraigned for some kind of spurious disturbing the peace charge. And when he was brought before a judge, the prosecutor could even explain why he'd been arrested. Well, he was arrested because Sheriff Arpaio doesn't like him, and he's one of Arpaio's antagonists, but he wasn't doing anything antagonizing when he was arrested. So there is a legitimate concern here about the prospect of police simply detaining somebody on the basis of a suspicion that this person doesn't have suitable identification to confirm that that person is in the country legally, and he or she fits some impression of what a illegal immigrant would look like. There are a number of very solid police chiefs and law enforcement officers in Arizona who have concerns about that measure for that reason. My problem of what happened here, Randy, is that neither side, and perhaps this is predictable because both sides are trying to milk this for political advantage, neither side addressed this as a 10th Amendment issue or what I call a Federalist 45 issue, that this is within the numerous and indefinite reserve powers of the states with respect to the police function. Neither side's addressing it from that issue or from that perspective. The people in Arizona who put this law together, they're not making that argument, and so it's not being addressed in court. I wish that would have been the route they would have taken, because whatever I think about the law, its merits and its problems, as far as I can tell, as a question of federalism, Arizona has the reserve power under the 10th Amendment to do what they did, and they're not defending it on that basis.
Well, yeah, I have the impression that there was some legitimacy to her ruling as well, but I don't know whether I would have taken it to the step to throw out the whole law, you know.
Well, there are elements of it that are going to go into effect, and unfortunately the worst elements are going to be unaffected by this that have to do with creating a pooling of data that would go into a national ID database. That's the part of the measure that I find most alarming and most unfortunate, and that's unaffected by the ruling. That part apparently has been left unaffected. So you're going to end up with the worst elements surviving here from all I can tell.
Are you familiar with Sheriff Richard Mack?
I know Sheriff Mack very well. I think very highly of him.
Well, I contacted him because he lives in Arizona, and I said, after the ruling came out, I said, what do you think about this? And he said, well, for one thing, he said, Governor Brewer is not a constitutional conservative. She's doing this for political purposes.
That's true,
and
as far as I can tell.
I said, why doesn't she just call out the National Guard and enforce this law regardless of what the federal judge said? And he says, well, I wish she would. He wrote me back and said, I wish she would do what you're suggesting, and that's what I would do. I would just tell this judge, I said, well, until my appeal goes through, I'm going to tell my police to enforce this law regardless of what your ruling says, and if you don't like it, tough, and then I'm going to call out the National Guard and put them on the border.
Like I said, those are 10th Amendment. Yeah, those are 10th Amendment type approaches here, and it's, I think, an illustration of the cynicism of Governor Brewer that she's not doing those things while she's spitting out this nonsense about Mexican immigrants beheading people in the desert and the idea that pretty much everybody who goes into Arizona as an illegal immigrant is a drug courier. Neither of those propositions are true. If you take a look at some of the research that's been done on the question of these supposedly decapitated bodies materializing in the desert, that's something that's been shot out of the water by people who've interviewed all the medical examiners along the border area there in southern Arizona. They say we don't have a single case where we found a decapitated body in the desert, but Brewer has said that twice on television. This is somebody, Governor Brewer, who opposed this until she realized that there was political capital to be gained by signing that measure into law, and I'm glad that Sheriff Mack confirmed that, because that was what I had learned as I looked into this issue. And Richard Mack, unlike Jan Brewer, is a person of principle. I think Brewer is looking to find some very convenient diversion, a political diversion, as she's looking to inflict this catastrophic sales tax increase on Arizona, which is in the throes of a full-orb depression right now. She's talking about raising sales taxes in a way that's going to crush a lot of the business in Arizona. And you've got, let me think here, I think it's almost 22% of that state, the homeowners are underwater on their mortgages right now. You've got an entire town, Maricopa, that was a whistle stop 10 years ago, turned into a town of 40,000 people during the housing boom, and now it's a ghost town. That's the sort of thing that's going on in Arizona right now while they're confecting this furor over SB 1070. And I think it's all a cynical, orchestrated political exercise, as transparently fraudulent as a professional wrestling match with none of the entertainment value.
Well, I don't think I would, if I was in a position to, I don't think I would support the Governor Brewer as a candidate, but I can, even though I question her motives, she's probably doing the right thing for the wrong reasons.
There are people who do that sometimes.
Yeah.
And there are people who act out of good motive.
If someone here I talked to about this today said, you know, even if she was to, by some stretch of the imagination, if she was to call out the National Guard, Obama would just come in and federalize them and take them out of her control. Well,
that's a possibility. Yeah, that's a possibility too. Randy, thanks so much for calling. You have a wonderful day, tomorrow, a wonderful Lord's Day, and have a good evening. Maybe I'll talk to you next week. God bless you. That was Randy from Florida. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397 on the Liberty News Radio Network. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes, and I'd love to hear from you, so stick around. Melissa Greenfield appeared to be a slender, ordinary 20-year-old woman wearing a neck brace. The device in her hand appeared to be a commonplace cell phone, but viewed in the light of the paramount law enforcement concern, officer safety, Greenfield was transformed into a potential smirch assassin. So the heroic Sergeant Jonathan Burke of Ohio's Delaware County Sheriff's Office simply had to arrest her, confiscate her property, and hold her in jail for 3 days, reports the Columbus Dispatch. At least that's how we're supposed to view what was done to Greenfield and her boyfriend Colton Dorich on July 9th at a Flying J truck stop near Columbus. Like many others their age, the vacationing couple was funding their trip across the country by soliciting donations from other travelers. While this could be called panhandling, it isn't a crime. Dorich's sign, which he displayed while walking his dog, triggered a passerby to call the police, which, by the way, is so typical of people. They must be doing something wrong because they make me feel vaguely uneasy. I think I'll summon the armed strangers in government-issued costumes. And nothing good comes from that, for the most part. When Burke arrived, he demanded that Dorich produce ID. Melissa withdrew her T-Mobile phone and announced that she was quite sensibly making a record of the event, quote, for legal purposes and our own safety. Unfortunately, Greenfield didn't understand that in any encounter between an armed agent of state coercion and a mere mundane, it is only the former who is entitled to protection. Quote, when a sheriff's deputy encounters an individual holding something in his or her hand, the deputy will take action to identify the item. This is done for the safety of the deputy, the involved parties, and the public, insisted Delaware County Sheriff Walter L. Davis III. Of course, safety in this context supposedly means unqualified submission to those wearing the habiliments of the state's punitive priesthood, who are indoctrinated to believe that they are compassed about by countless potentially lethal threats. Not knowing what the item in her hand was and having prior knowledge of all types of hidden weapons, including a cell phone gun, I asked her several times to place it in her pocket and keep her hands free, wrote the timid Sergeant Burke in his official report. Several years ago, 22 caliber pistols disguised as cell phones were seized in raids against organized crime syndicates in Europe. This generated a small wave of alarmist stories about this new threat to officer safety, one that supposedly changed the rules of engagement in police encounters. The disguised pistols are heavier than common cell phones. The chamber is loaded by twisting the phone, quote-unquote, in half. To date, not a single deadly decoy of that kind has materialized in the United States. Burke demanded that Greenfield surrender the camera. She properly refused that demand, so the armed stranger abducted Greenfield under color of supposed law by arresting her and charging her with obstructing official business and resisting arrest. Dorich wasn't charged. Let me interject something here. Obstructing official business and resisting arrest is a cover charge. It's a compound cover charge. This is the sort of thing that a police officer will improvise when he wants to arrest somebody but can't find an actual crime to justify the arrest. In my opinion, and this is something I've written about extensively, and if you want to go and look at Pro Libertate, the blog, look for restoring the right to resist in the search engine, you'll find a detailed argument and list of relevant citations from Supreme Court decisions and lower court decisions to validate my opinion that in circumstances in which no crime has been committed and an officer is acting in a way that is self-advantaging at the expense of the rights of somebody who's not committed a crime or given probable cause of the same, the citizen has the right and the duty to resist by all means at his or her disposal. In other words, if Melissa Greenfield would have had it in her power to put that officer down on his back, she should have done so. And if the officer had made an issue out of it, other citizens should have come to Greenfield's aid. And until we're willing to do that sort of thing in circumstances where it is possible and appropriate, things are not going to improve. The young woman who was wearing a neck brace following a traffic accident was held in jail for 3 days before pleading no contest to the spurious obstruction charge, for which she was fined $20. The equally bogus resisting arrest charge, which isn't a crime, it's common law right, was dismissed. After it became clear that this mysterious object Greenfield carried was a common cell phone and not exotic Eastern European spy tech, it was returned, but the video record of the police stop had been erased. Fancy that. As Burke drove Greenfield to jail, he lectured his kidnapping victim about the supposed danger she posed to him. The sergeant insisted that it was, quote, unacceptable for me to be filming his activities, Greenfield told the dispatch. It may have been unacceptable to Burke, whose mind was cluttered with paranoid self-serving fantasies, but as Greenfield observes, there was no actual law against making a video record of police carrying out official tasks. Because Burke was armed, he was able to impose his will on Greenfield. This is precisely the kind of bullying that the rule of law is supposed to prevent. Like too many others supposedly entrusted to enforce the law to protect the public, Sergeant Burke has been taught to act in the service of his unreasonable fears in the interest of his own self-protection. We go to the phones. James from South Carolina is with us this evening. James, how are you doing?
Okay. I have a couple of questions.
How may I be of service to you?
One of the callers asked something about the National Guard.
Yeah.
I have two questions. Can one state send a its National Guard to help another state?
My understanding is that that's not constitutionally appropriate. I don't think there is anything wrong with a state petitioning the general government, what's now called the federal government, what's commonly called the federal government, for aid of that sort, and the aid could take the form of another state sending its National Guard to help. But to the best of my understanding, it's not permissible for one state to intervene that way.
So one governor could not ask the next door governor for aid with its national guard?
There's nothing at all wrong. This is interesting. I think there's nothing at all wrong with one state sending out a general muster call for the unorganized militia, as opposed to the select militia, which is what the National Guard would be. That's how the National Guard would be described, I think, in the terms that the founders used.
Okay. One other. When the president nationalizes the National Guard, what has to take place? Suppose the governor resists.
Well, you might remember what happened in 1963 in Alabama. I mean, literally, they were at the point in 1963 in Alabama and in 1957 in Little Rock,
yeah,
where you had the presidents, respectively, there would have been Kennedy and Eisenhower, send in troops for the purpose of forcing the state National Guard to step down. And these people went in many instances, locked and cocked and ready to rock. So that's not a hypothetical. And in light of the fact that since 2006, we've had this measure that effectively permits the president to nationalize the National Guard, federalize the National Guard, and operate through a council of governors to ratify his decisions, we're at that point right now where Obama could do that sort of thing. And that's the sort of thing, once again,
the president can't do it by fiat.
I'm sorry?
He has to go through this other outfit, right?
No, the Council of Governors is an advisory body. They don't have any policymaking function. As a matter of legislation that was approved over the objections of, Senator Leahy, of all the unlikely people, you have a framework now, a legal framework, spurious, but it's still legislatively enacted, that would provide the president with the means to use the National Guard as his Praetorian Guard. And that's a legacy of the Bush administration. That's not something Obama did. He inherited that.
So if the president can, he could, just to state it, he could make all the National Guards for whatever reason,
and deploy them anywhere he sees fit.
He wants to?
Yes, to deal with combinations against the public interest. That's part of the legislative language. That's terrifying stuff. It basically nullified what limits were placed by the Insurrectionary Act against that type of presidential militarism for domestic use.
Suppose a state legislature said no.
That's,
I mean,
what I'm thinking.
I mean, you have a constitutional crisis. I mean,
yeah, and suppose suppose in Arizona or in Idaho or someplace else there was a tax escrow act passed that would treat the income tax like any other apportioned tax and hold it here in the state rather than sending it to Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that's been discussed since Pete Santarussa suggested it decades ago, and there's a measure of that sort being proposed in Arizona right now. What if that were to happen? I think that it's very possible you would see the trigger pulled on the Praetorian Guard option. And the precedent would be Little Rock in 1957 or Mobile, Alabama in 1963.
Well, when was the power given to the president to do this? I mean, at one time it existed, and one time it didn't exist.
Yeah, maybe it was 2006 with the National Guard Reorganization Act, I believe it was called. Hey, James, we got to go. We're going to a hard break now.
Thanks
so much for calling. God bless you. God bless all the rebels in South Carolina. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio and Liberty News Radio Network. We'll be right back at you.
System memory crash.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
Just a couple of very quick points here before we go back to the phones. I've made mention of a 2006 act that changed in some significant way the architecture of the National Guard so as to make it more of a tool of the presidential will than it had been. That act was amended by Senators Leahy of Vermont, Democrat, and Kit Bond of Missouri. The problem is that they folded the National Guard, which was once the independent militia of the several states that was under a civilian chain of command that included the state legislature and the governor of the state, folding the National Guard into the Army. And it created, according to the official description of the amendment posed by Leahy and Bond, a stronger relationship between the Guard and the Northern Command. And it instructed, this measure did, the Pentagon to work with the Guard in planning homeland defense. The Northern Command, of course, is the continental United States. And beginning January 11th of this year, the Obama administration set about to create a Council of Governors to help synchronize policy regarding foreign and domestic military operations. The Council of Governors will be a bipartisan panel of 10 state governors who meet at the call of various executive functionaries, not the president necessarily, but the Secretaries of Defense and Homeland Security, to assist the Supreme Leader, meaning the president, in carrying out the synchronization and integration of state and federal military activities in the United States, with a special emphasis on the role of the National Guard. So what we have here, once again, is an operational framework for using the National Guard as the president's Praetorian Guard and deploying them anywhere in the country the president considers to be appropriate for the task of dealing with combinations or insurrections. Now, I had made mention before of the proposed constitutional tax funds escrow legislation, which has been proposed in Arizona. There's a measure of that sort proposed in Washington. Basically, what the federal tax funds escrow legislation would do would be to interdict the federal government's consumption of taxes raised within the state, income taxes, which are a spurious enactment according to the Constitution, and it would be a reassertion of the apportionment process, which is supposed to be the constitutional framework for collecting revenue. It's a complicated subject. Perhaps next week I'll go into it in more depth. But I think that if you end up with a situation where a state is actually working to reclaim its status with respect specifically to the taxing authority, that's when the trigger will be pulled and we'll end up seeing the Little Rock scenario playing out with respect to the federalized National Guard. That's just one possibility. We'll have to take that under advisement and see what happens in the future. Justin from Chicago has been waiting patiently to speak with us this evening. Justin, how are you doing?
Doing well, William. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. I wanted to ask you about something you just mentioned, Mr. Obama's Council of Governors and Jan Brewer's appointment to the council, and speaking of cynical politicians.
Yeah.
What's your take on that?
Well, once again, I find myself wondering if we're not dealing with an angle, to use the professional wrestling expression, because you might remember in pro wrestling, one of the things that happen is that you'll have these guys going at each other hammer and tongs in the ring, apparently beating the living daylights out of each other, and then they'll get on the same car and go to a bar and hoist a few. I think we might be dealing with that kind of a scenario here, because it is to the mutual benefit of both of them to keep this controversy going. There's nothing substantive that's changing here with respect to the specific issue of immigration, but there are things that are changing with respect to the nature of law enforcement, the militarization of law enforcement in this country. You got these people almost playing some weird collaborative riff on the Briar Patch game. Don't throw me in the Briar Patch. You got Jan Brewer and John McCain and the others saying, we need the military here. We need the military manning the border. We need more troops than the president's willing to send. And you know what? Obama wants to deploy troops domestically. Any president's going to want to do that. Any president is going to want to, well, maybe with a couple of exceptions I can think of in history, but none within recent memory, just about any president is going to want to be able to exercise his powers domestically in order to compel people to conform to his will. And these people are either not thinking things through. Jan Brewer, by the way, doesn't strike me as somebody upon whom the burden of intellect rests heavily. Or maybe they're thinking things through and they're basically playing an angle. But I'm of the opinion that it's probably some version of the latter.
I totally agree with you, Will. And I also wanted to interject here, if I could, because harkening back to something you said in the first hour regarding, was it Max Boot? Plan, like Rome, plan for Rome, basically, is the way you described it?
Yeah. Oh, with respect to the use of... Go ahead.
What's your take on foreign nationals enlisting in the United States Armed Forces?
In order to answer that question, I have to point out that I don't think we should have a military establishment of the sort we have right now. I mean, the Constitution was designed in such a way that the Army could have funds appropriated only for 2 years at a stretch. And maintaining a navy, of course, was something that the Congress is supposed to do. They're supposed to maintain a navy, but an army is an establishment that we really shouldn't have. We should have a citizen militia. And by virtue of being a citizen, of course, you're a member of the unorganized militia, and that would seem, by strict Aristotelian definition, to exclude non-citizens. That's not to say that they wouldn't have the right of self-defense. It's just to say that they wouldn't be part of a citizen militia. But we shouldn't have an imperial military establishment that these people could enlist in to begin with. If you forgive me for ending both of those clauses with prepositions. Max Boot, or as I call him, Caligula. Caligula meant little boots. And Max Boot, of course, is one of these Council on Foreign Relations folks who like to repeat step by step all the procedures that led to the end of the British Empire, the Roman Empire, and so forth. He suggested that we ought to create an international freedom legion, as he describes it, where people would be permitted to become citizens if they enlisted in the imperial military for a set term. And I think that that's a pretty good recipe for disaster. I mean, that basically is what happened in the late 3rd century, when suddenly Honorius looked up and he was knee-deep in Visigoths. The Visigoths, that is to say the Germans, had been guarding the borders of the empire for a generation by that point. And so I think that's pretty much the sort of thing that's likely to happen if we end up in a situation where the policymaking elite acts on suggestions like those of Max Boot and company.
It's looking more and more like a American foreign legion, so to speak.
Yeah, very much so.
All right, thanks a lot, Will. Thanks for everything.
Oh, thank you. God bless you, Justin. It's great to hear from you. We have time for one more caller, I think. John from Winnipeg, I believe. How are you doing this evening? Yes, sir.
Hey, William. Yeah, what you're talking about there, I thought it was kind of interesting. Overman had covered Obama's challenge to the state of Arizona on this issue. And chorused what I've been saying since the thing was first announced, and it was really quite cool. As you might be aware, he argued that the fact is if you're a legal American citizen and you don't have all your papers on you, the cops are obliged to have you arrested until you can provide your citizenship. So
that would include an out-of-state license,
and
that would include an out-of-state driver's license too.
Yeah, and the other thing that was cool, too, on this issue is that violent crime has gone down 19% over the last 19% over the last 10 years in Arizona. Property crime's down 20%. There's a city right on the border of Arizona with Mexico, 27% unemployment, no gun rules. You know, everybody's got a gun or whatever. And there's illegal, probably half of the city is likely illegal immigrants. And they got the lowest, one of the lowest crime rates in all the United States.
As a matter of fact, John, if I'm not mistaken, the four cities with the lowest crime rates are all border cities in the southwestern United States.
San Diego, Laredo, to Baltimore. They were doing. I forget the show now, but they were comparing it to Baltimore, which is a smaller city, and the murders are more than 10 times as high, and it's a much more violent place to live. You know, if they're infringing on our freedoms, let's stop them from committing these criminal actions. But they're not really arguing that. They want to divide us. You heard Sanchez today on CNN. Christians want to burn the Quran. Like, it's just demonic.
what a good idea that is.
Isn't going to be honorable. He isn't going to say, look, it's got nothing to do with Islam. It's got to do with a bunch of criminals in the Bush administration that halted the FBI from completing the task to nab the actual bad guys. They should be arguing satanic? Because to be Christ-like is to treat people equitably. Why do you want to unfairly castigate all these more than a billion people in a bad light?
They want to because it appeals to the visceral reptilian brain atavistic collectivist impulse. And there are people who are cultivating it, and there are people who are profiting from it. John, thanks so much for your call. All of you, have a wonderful Lord's Day tomorrow. Join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com for Pro Libertate, the blog. Go to libertynewsradio.com and look at the archives. This program is going to be up there shortly. And when you go to freedominourtime.blogspot.com, if you have the means and the inclination, there's a PayPal button there you can use to donate. Sure appreciate it. That's how I try to feed my family. Be back with you next week. And until then, as always, Dum Spiro Pugno. While I breathe, I fight. Good night, good luck, and God bless.